Chapter 5. The strip malls and office parks of Grand Rapids gave way to fields and maple groves, already here and there bright red and orange. Maynard was as eager for school to begin as Kurt was about his upcoming move to Boston, and during the drive to Scottville, the two plotted how they'd spend their brief time together before embarking on their new ventures. They'd re-establish connections with old friends, certainly. Classmates and fellow cross-country runners and girlfriends Maynard hadn't seen since entering the service 3 years before. A few miles past Muskegon, Kurt replaced the cassette in the boombox. They looked at each other and grinned. R.E.M.'s eerily appropriate lyrics urged them never to return to the wasted years of dead-end factory jobs in some faraway xenophobic small town. "I heard you are a punk now," Maynard's grandmother had written from Ohio soon after he'd turned down the West Point invitation. "I thought being in the army would make you grow up." Hers was a typical reaction. Mike and Jan hid their shock when they saw his haircut, and Jan eventually admitted that the mohawk was a fine example of creative expression. And once he reminded them that attending art school had always been his goal, they let go their disappointment over West Point and admitted their pride in his Kendall acceptance. But his former classmates quickly found excuses to cut their visits short. He watched them go, most likely to down a McDonald's vanilla shake spiked with peppermint schnapps in preparation for another night at Johnny's.
"I came back to Scottville and was completely ostracized and crucified by these guys and ignored by the girl who I took to the prom. I came back after the army with my hair shaved into a mohawk and they went, 'Get thee behind me, Satan.' Come on, dude, I told you I was going to do this."
As always, Maynard and Kurt found in each other all the company they really needed. Maynard shared with his friend the EP club mixes he'd brought from Texas, Gary Newman, Alien Sex Fiends, Dark Ballads of Lords of the New Church, the experimental structures and atmospheric harmonies that satisfied their search for the new, the different, the daring. They talked through the night, imagining Boston and the clubs and music and friends Kurt would find there. His plan was to follow no plan, travel with no map, experience to the fullest whatever the city might hold. He'd worry about a job when he got there. After all, he and Maynard agreed, the key to success was to first prepare the scene, like a stagehand dressing the set, and then to step confidently into it. Maynard settled into the apartment he'd share with fellow student and White Room guitarist Chris Ewald. The house stood at the edge of Heritage Hill, the neighborhood of stately Greek Revival and Queen Anne homes built from the city's lumber barons a century before. Only a few blocks from campus and downtown Grand Rapids, Cherry Street seemed the ideal location for a student eager to explore the city. Grand Rapids offered the diversity and cultural attractions of a major metropolis, fine restaurants, museums, and resident symphony, opera, and ballet companies. Even so, the city retained the close-minded aura of an isolated small town, numbingly conservative, and proud to be home to the central offices of the Christian Reformed Church. By the fall of 1985, gentrification was already in full swing, forcing black families far from the neighborhoods they'd called home. Angry minorities and a religious right nonetheless joined against a common enemy, art students in chains and spiked hair. Warnings to stay on one side of the tracks were meaningless in a town like Grand Rapids, where invisible boundaries separated the districts. Downtown was uptown, was crosstown, was college town, and Maynard soon learned that his best defense was a thick skin and a lead pipe tucked in one sleeve of his leather jacket.
Whatever that particular religion was, they'd apparently found a clause in their good book to justify oppression. People in the black neighborhoods were being treated horribly, so the pushback was that any time they had a chance to beat the shit out of a student with a baseball bat, they would. That put me at risk whenever I wanted to go to Subway for a sandwich.
Most of the time, the attacks were only derogatory shouts from the safety of the opposite side of the street. Indifferent to the taunts, Maynard focused on his part-time job assisting with demolition and painting and hanging drywall at another of his landlord Bill's properties, and felt the safest when he lost himself in a frenzy of crayon and paper and pen and clay. He discovered the fine arts program to be Kendall's red-headed stepchild, second fiddle to the school's more conventional design department. Not surprising, in a town nicknamed Furniture City, Kendall focused on preparing students for careers at nearby American Seating and Steelcase, lifelong careers designing desks and file cabinets and laying out four-color magazine ads. The curriculum provided a solid foundation, but left little room for exploration and innovation. Maynard sought out the department's renegade subculture, the small cadre of nonconformists keen to invent their own personae and their own art, the fringe group that embraced their individuality and outsider status. He found in them comrades in music, prepared to discuss with him Nick Cave's chord progressions and the poetry of Joni Mitchell's lyrics. Yet even among the avant-garde punks and armchair anarchists, Maynard, in his tight leather pants and jacket trimmed with bleached chicken bones and a coiled bass string, stood out, and to everyone's surprise, was named student council president in the fall.
The art students use spray fixatives to preserve our charcoal drawings, but there is no ventilation system in the studios. I went to the foundation to get them interested in our health, but they didn't do anything. So I tried to get the students to come to a meeting and demand action. I posted notices in the break room, circulated a petition, but they didn't pay attention. Finally, I drew a really aggressive Sid Vicious on bright red paper and made a poster saying that we'd talk about it at the next student council meeting. A lot of people said the flyer was offensive and too punk, but people showed up who'd never come to the student council meeting before. They came because they were pissed off about what I'd drawn. That's the difference between illustration and design. You put something controversial out there and people notice and actually do something. My marketing prowess ended up with my getting elected student council president.
Maynard was an advocate for justice at all levels, Kendall drawing instructor Deb Rockman would later recall. He was all about creating the best possible experience for students. An icy December squall rattled the windows of Kendall's break room, where students sat with books and Walkmans, their late dinners a hodgepodge of the few selections still available in the cafeteria. One glanced nervously outside, where snow fell faster. He must brave the 45-minute trip to his parents' house, he told his friends, the drive he made to and from school each day. Maynard recognized him as Ramiro Rodriguez, the diligent student whose sure lines and warm palate he'd admired all semester, whose intriguing images skillfully combined the mythological and the familiar. Ramiro had noticed Maynard, too, his combat boots and white anarchy symbol painted across the back of his jacket. He looked up from his plate, unsure for a moment just how to respond to Maynard's announcement of a vacant room at Cherry Street. Coming from a small town, I was amazed that there was anybody like that around, Ramiro would recall. Maynard was one of a kind, even in art school, but I was desperate to move closer to campus, and my car was dying. The next day, Ramiro arrived to find the apartment strewn with canvases and brushes, a four-track recorder, two guitars propped against chairs as if they'd been set there mid-song, and a crowbar against the wall near the front door. I'm not sure what convinced me that living there was going to be all right, Ramiro would confess. I was totally out of my element, but I thought, well, he seems like a decent enough guy. He dresses weird and all, but living here might be kind of exciting. Friends gathered at the Cherry Street apartment at all hours to exchange cassettes and their latest drawings and poems. When Maynard's part-time job didn't require him to head across town to paint or hang drywall at another of his landlord's properties, He and Ramiro prepared quiches and casseroles for their guests with fresh vegetables and lentils from the nearby food co-op. "Planting acorns. I'm planting acorns," he'd answer when asked about his activities, as if he realized that, given enough time, the most esoteric of skills, the most dubious of investments, might one day provide a return. At the end of the school year, Maynard was one of only 10 students, and the sole freshman, whose work was selected to travel the Midwest as part of Kendall's recruitment effort. His charcoal life drawing would be displayed at college fairs and career days, representing the exceptional quality of Kendall's students' work. He proudly told Kurt of the honor when Kurt visited Grand Rapids that spring. On high alert, the pair walked about the Cherry Street neighborhood beneath greening ash and Norway maples, Maynard's lead pipe hidden inside one sleeve. Kurt described the wonders of New England, the endless selection of beer at the Wursthaus in Harvard Square, the ornate Symphony Hall, and the gritty Rotskeller, the center of Boston's rock scene. He told him of his job as wine buyer for Martignetti Liquors, and his study of aldehydes and maceration and vin, both ordinaire and premium, in order to master his craft. Back at the apartment, Maynard cleared cassettes, crimped tubes of oils, and hoghair brushes from his kitchen chairs. He brought from the dish drainer 2 tumblers, while Kurt lined across the table the half-dozen bottles he'd bought from Martignetti's high-end lockup. Maynard sipped the 1961 Krug Rosé, mystified by his friend's talk of tannins and complexity and balance and varietals. He marveled at Kurt's ability to detect base notes of oak or citrus or vanilla in what he called the wine's finish. Baffled, Maynard set his glass on the Formica tabletop and turned to the subject of his drawings, his excitement over his growing understanding of line, shading, and perspective, of his sometimes girlfriend, Laurie Rousseau, and of the plan for the next evening. They'd visit the Ice Pick, he told Kurt, the punk music venue in the Muskegon countryside, the raucous club where not long ago he'd performed with the area's newest group, Children of the Anachronistic Dynasty. For all its straight-laced conservatism, Grand Rapids was the vortex of a lively music scene, one of the many such areas that had emerged in the mid-80s to cater to unconventional young people living far from the cities. Their guide was Steve Aldrich, host of WLAV's radio weekly Clambake, the alternative music program featuring punk and new wave and local indie bands. With a keen ear for quality and an unerring sense for the next big thing, Aldrich gave Western Michigan youth their first taste of the latest sound. Primed for the real thing, they bought fresh packs of clove cigarettes and attached a few more safety pins to their shirt fronts. They made their way to shows at the Ice Pick and in function halls and condemned storefronts on Division Street, where the only stage lighting might be fixtures fashioned from bulbs and coffee cans. All the top hardcore bands were coming through Grand Rapids, Aldrich would recall. People could see the very best, and I think that influenced a lot of them to put together their own bands. The shredding guitar riffs and anti-establishment lyrics were a call to break free of the disco years and the narcissism of the me generation, just as the music ignored conventional structures and traditional rhyme schemes. Musicians took up their drums and guitars, whether they understood chord changes and rhythmic patterns or not. These hipsters intent upon bringing music to the masses in new, non-elitist forms. The early punks didn't want to turn into Michael Jackson or be on the cover of Tiger Beat, Maynard would explain. They felt privileged to be hearing stuff no one else had discovered. Maynard and Laurie drove along Alpine Avenue to Top of the Rock, an isolated warehouse of a building deep in the woods. Punks and goths and sensitive art school students paid the $3 cover to experience live bands and Thursday's alternative night, a celebration of anarchy in the middle of farm country. Maynard showed me there was another way of looking at the world, Laurie would recall. There were people making music and art who saw things differently than the mainstream and acted on those views. I'd been on the outside for so long growing up that it was a relief to find them. The DJ spun Fear and the Cure, Erasure and New Order, and in Doc Martens and dog collars and multicolored mullets, the crowd came forward to dance. Partway through the evening, the more timid among them retreated to the shadows as the dance floor became a slam pit where skinheads and the most radical of the punks hurled themselves against one another in a frenzy of headbanging and unchoreographed flailing, until inevitably one fell, and in the spirit of solidarity, the others scrambled to help him to his feet. Maynard had the inkling that visual art wasn't, after all, the medium for him. He preferred the collaborative atmosphere of the punk clubs, the almost palpable sensation of energy that flowed between musician and spectator. Band members turned to one another and their audience, attuned to their every nuance, drawing from the energy in order to co-create an experience that excluded no one.
Art exhibitions seemed self-indulgent, and all these sycophants showed up, claiming to understand the paintings. It had been so long since I stood in front of something original and said, wow, that changed my life. It felt like advertising and design had no soul, no pulse. Then I'd look at what they were doing in the visual arts and think, just go get therapy. When I saw a room full of people literally and figuratively tuning into each other to create rhythms and images, it just made sense.
In the fall, Maynard and Chris took an apartment in another of Bill's buildings, a semi-refurbished house at 649 Evans Street. Ramiro, concerned that the hammering and drilling and drywall dust would disrupt his studies, opted for a less chaotic space a few blocks away. But for Maynard, whose only requirement was room for music gear, the apartment was ideal. The canvases in his living room and his half-empty tubes of oils would last until another odd job turned up, he calculated, and he withdrew what he dared from his college fund. With it, he purchased a PV Black Widow amp, a Korg drum machine, and a Tascam four-track recorder, and turned to his writing with a new seriousness. He took as his influences the bands whose styles most intrigued him. Depeche Mode, Ministry, Black Flag, Kiss, of course, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and local punk-meets-metal fusion group, Born Without a Face. He created linear soundscapes embellished with mantra-like drones and crafted minimalist lyrics that left room for listeners to inhabit the songs and fill the silence with stories of their own. Yet the complex constructions were all his. I was trying to abandon the easy intro-verse-chorus-bridge-chorus-chorus format, he would explain. You can take almost any popular song, whether it's rock or pop or R&B or country, and lay them right over the top of each other, and they all match up. There's nothing different about them. And with a little help from his rhythm guitarist friend, Kevin Horning, CAD became a reality, if not a live band. Recorded in his living room and duplicated at a recording studio north of campus, its two cassettes, the 1986 Fingernails and Doghouse in 1987, sold for $5 each and realized enough sales to cover Maynard's modest rent. The quality of the cassettes was remarkable, given the simple equipment Maynard worked with in his living room. He'd learned to program the Korg to create delays and overdubs of sound and echo, producing tracks like the haunting 25 Hours, a strident sermon sampled beneath the repetitive melody, and segueing into a chant evocative of the sound of an army marching in lockstep into battle. He included, with each cassette, a copy of the CAD Manifesto, a rambling screed addressing materialism, AIDS, and global warming, issuing a call for the union of opposites in a polarized world, and ending in a message of hope.
Based on our being merely average in the field of corporate middle-class TV-watching American consumerism, we, the children, have reached the following conclusions, predictions, out of need. What need? Well, we needed to know why things don't work. Why we cure cancer with cancer and pursue peace by building bombs. We needed to know why we know the ozone is the problem by manufacturing and producing number 29 extra strength sunscreen with tropical blend. We need to know why we, in our advanced state of space travel and genetic research, haven't discovered a cure for AIDS as of yet, and why we attempt to end racial prejudices by acknowledging the separation. We need to know why we think that he who dies with the most toys is the winner, and why all that we consider success can be physically taken away from us. Why? Because we are the victims of the dualistic cause-effect paradigm that merely lacks empathy. 1 + 1 + 1 = 1. Unless you are a slave to this dualistic Western Rambo culture, and then 1 + 1 = 2. No longer do we experience the harmonious interaction between each other and our environment. All that we see experienced here is in twos, like opposites, black and white, good and bad, us and them. Therefore, we the children have reached the fear of the following. In 5 years, we will discover a cure for AIDS merely because it began to seriously affect heterosexuals 1 year previous. In 10 years, there will be no more cold winters. In 10 years, heat from unfiltered ultraviolet rays will result in drought and frenzy. Drought and frenzy will result in mass starvation and race riots. In 10 years, those without toys will take from those with toys, and soon all those toys will break, become meaningless, and be forgotten. In 10 years, the Mercedes, the job securities, the stocks, the bank accounts, and the master's degrees will no longer be considered elements of success. In 12 years, safe shelter, food, extra ammo for the rifle, surviving a raid or making a profitable raid, and just plain surviving will be considered true success. In 15 years, fewer and fewer will be successful because of lesser and lesser food for which to be successful. In 15 years, those who established isolated strongholds because they felt they were a superior breed or race will find that the person in the bunk next to them is more of a derelict and an imbecile than the person or persons they burned or murdered 5 years earlier merely because of their color. In 15 years, this tape will not matter. The instruments used to play and produce it will not matter. Whether you have a few dollars it takes to purchase it will not matter. But what is said on it is timeless. It cannot be erased or taken away from us. It is forever. And in 20 years, when the ice caps have melted, Mother Nature will have another go at it. And hopefully, as time progresses in this new world, there will be no need for another bloodline of misplaced youth. Amen and thank you. We are CAD.
Maynard's sense of humor intact, he became a devotee of another local group, the acerbically humorous Texans. Texans was Tex and the Anti-Nazi Squad, their music a comedic offshoot of alt-rock. Led by Grand Rapids punk rocker Clint Tex Porker, Texans was a talented lineup, including horning and keyboardist Mike Mings. But as Maynard learned after attending only a few of their performances, sorely lacked a bass player. With his dwindling funds, he brought home a Hohner knockoff Steinberger bass. "I didn't know how to play bass, but I knew I could figure it out," he would recall. "I thought, it can't be that hard. It has only 4 strings, so I'll even have an extra finger to use." Maynard's short time with the band was a period of concentrated creativity, a time to explore his potential as a musician and to hone his performance and recording skills. Soon he was appearing with Texans at the local venues he'd visited only weeks before, this time center stage, bass in hand. Texans recorded its February 1986 performance for its first release, live at Sons and Daughters Hall, a collection of 16 songs, including the tongue-in-cheek Big Dead Things, a warning to step carefully across the kitchen and the front lawn. Maynard collaborated on the band's second release, Never Again, an independently produced 17-track cassette of garage punk. He did the best he could on bass, and unwilling to completely abandon the visual, created album art for both Never Again and local band Real Bodine's single, I Won't Take It. Porker's unexpected move that spring left the band without a vocalist, and Maynard stepped up to fill the role. With a bass player and rhythm guitarist, a drummer, and Kevin on lead guitar, the band was complete. But it wasn't long before Maynard realized it wasn't merely Texans reconfigured. The band was CAD. Maynard's 76 Plymouth Arrow, with its Batman logo and tiger stripes, soon became a familiar sight on the Grand Rapids streets. Between classes, he dashed to the copy shop to run off flyers announcing upcoming CAD performances, and crisscrossed the city to attach them to message boards and lampposts, creating a grassroots buzz that reached the WLAV studios. The station did special programming for that kind of music, Aldrich would recall. Some of CAD was almost novelty, some of it was noise. But then there was a sound like early Tangerine Dream. There were things in CAD that if Maynard had had a producer, they would have gone, oh my God. CAD saw its media debut in April as part of public access station GRTV's 1987 Peace Day programming. The 26-minute performance featured 7 songs. Maynard, his eyes rimmed in black eyeliner, glaring intermittently at the camera as he sang. In his black tank top and tight black pants rolled mid-calf just above the laces of his Grecian sandals, he tossed his head in time to the music to better call attention to his mohawk and the bleached strands in his long curls. He strutted back and forth across the stage, his single metallic earring glittering. In an interview following the performance, Maynard explained the meaning of the acronym CAD. "It's not really a band name," he said. "It's more a concept behind what we're all about. It stands for Children of the Anachronistic Dynasty, which is kind of like a bloodline of youth born out of sync with time, out of sync enough to where they sit back and observe rather than just take things for granted." Maynard wasn't content to limit his work to one band, and branched out with Mings to form the short-lived Malicious Sissies, a hybrid punk digital duo locally known for a time for its songs Hallucination and Who Leads You.
Mike was a computer dude who loved drum machines and programming and sequencing. He and I would go to Gaia, this coffee shop and organic restaurant on Diamond Ave. They had an open mic night that was mostly acoustic, and Last Train to Clarksville was always the closing number. Mike and I would get there with the drum machine, and I'm singing with a delay pedal through a mic. We were doing a very digital thing in a very crunchy granola setting, and people actually paid attention.
But CAD was the band that true punk aficionados followed from gig to gig, from the Intersection Bar downtown to City Center Mall, where shoppers paused in their quest for golf shirts and pillowcases and oversized chocolate chip cookies to stand and listen. CAD stood beneath the flashing lights of Top of the Rock, the audience clustered at the stage, eager to be among the first to hear Burn About Out. They swayed in the spiral of staccato percussion echo, Maynard's insistent lyrics rising above the surge of sound. "Count the bodies," he urged them. "Take note of the specter lurking just behind."
"Waiting like a stalking butler who upon the finger rests, murder now the path of must we, just because the sun has come."
"Keep going with that," Chris Ewell told Maynard after the show. "That's the song. Whatever that is, keep pursuing it." With CAD's popularity came the attention of Grand Rapids girls keen to date someone just like Maynard. It was the rare evening that no one waited for him after a CAD performance or accompanied him to one of the clubs downtown.
"A guy in a leather coat and a mohawk is absolutely the polar opposite of what their fathers would choose for them. I'm the outsider, the guy not allowed to pollute the gene pool in any way, and I had the keys of the chastity belt. There's a lot of making up for lost time in those years, and I definitely made some mistakes, but I wouldn't change any of it."
The highlight of the summer would be Black Flag's Grand Rapids stop as part of its 1986 Michigan tour. Maynard's opportunity to once again experience the band he'd seen in Austin, this time in the more intimate setting of Burton Hall. Drugstore turned punk venue, the hall had been gutted of all but a dysfunctional sink in one corner, and the space promised plenty of room for a packed house and a slam pit. He arrived early, surprised to find no line at the door. He'd been certain a crowd would turn out to see Henry Rollins, if not the opening band, Dos Damon. But with the first notes of the second opener, he forgot his surroundings. Gone, the instrumental side project of Black Flag guitarist Greg Ginn, exploded in a fusion of sound and fury. Ginn's crashing guitar, the percussive power of longtime Black Flag drummer Sim Kane, and Andrew Weiss's ferocious bass transformed the drab hall to a swirling eddy of energy. Weiss's was bass as Maynard had never imagined it. True playing, not merely a striking of strings in time to a kick drum, an artistic level far beyond his own anemic attempts. Gone was followed by the equally commanding Painted Willie, the L.A. punk group formed by drummer and filmmaker Dave Markey, and by the time Black Flag took the stage, Maynard was aware only of the intensity, the professionalism, the purity and energy of a reality he could only hope to inhabit. Then Ginn picked up his guitar again. His intense attack underscored Rollins's vocals and his message of rebellious individualism and defiance of authority, the fierce lyrics of fear and isolation. Black Flag's 90-minute set was a controlled bedlam of sheer sound, a crashing riot of syncopated metal, astonishing jazz fusion, and inventive percussion that brazenly defied traditional rhythmic structures. But Burton Hall remained virtually empty, the sadly underpromoted show having attracted only a fraction of its capacity. It was amazing to see these bands playing to the sparse crowd, Maynard recalled in a 2012 interview. The energy they put into their performance was breathtaking. His music might turn completely from the expected, Maynard thought, and envisioned an instrumental trio of his chordal bass, Ewald's guitar rhythms, and inventive percussion. And when Chris brought Steve Aldrich into the discussion, he agreed to come on board. I was way up for that, he recalled, confident the sonic spaces he created with his Yamaha drum kit would complement the sound Maynard had in mind. The music was going to be very, very dark, Aldrich would explain. It wasn't going to be hardcore, but somewhere not too far from Killing Joke. Brainstorming sessions were sporadic, and rehearsals few, but the three believed in their collaboration. This band would be so unique, so unconventional, so postmodern, that its very title must be unspoken. Maynard designed the symbol that would serve as its name, a black and white UPC barcode. After their meetings, Ewald and Aldrich urged Maynard to join them at a nearby pub. We tried to get him out of the house and have a beer with us, Aldrich would recall. He always said no. He had music to work on. He was so very, very dedicated. Focused as he was on his art, Maynard nonetheless made room for the comedic.
A friend and I would make mixtapes for a woman he knew. One day we started fucking around in the studio making really dumb songs to send her as a joke. Then we all dressed up and rented a VHS recorder and did one of those songs on camera. We wandered around Grand Rapids in stupid outfits filming each other being silly. Our film ended with me walking in our door with cigarette butts stuck up in my lip and a baseball cap on sideways. On camera, my friend punches me in the face and I spit my teeth across the room. We called that character Billy Bob.
Maynard sat back on a bench in the downtown amphitheater. The early July sunshine, reflected from windows of banks and department stores surrounding the park, was warm on his face, and he remembered the recent festival of disillusioned rebels on nearby Punker Hill, the chaos of leather and goth and spiked hair. But he couldn't waste the afternoon in reminiscence. He must stop at the pet store for seed for the latest addition to the Evans Street apartment, the newly hatched zebra finch, the little bird with bright orange beak and shiny black eyes he'd named Harpo. He watched a giddy group of neo-flower children in tattered jeans and bright flounced skirts weave hand in hand under the brick arch and up and down the tiered risers. They paused in their dance and breathlessly approached Maynard, eager to share their excitement. "The Rainbow Gathering," they announced. "The Rainbow Gathering in the Smoky Mountains, and they were going there now, and he must join them." Maynard had considered visiting Scottville during his summer break, but 4 days in the mountains and valleys of North Carolina was tempting. He loaded his Chevy Sprint with a few essentials, left Harpo in the care of his roommates, picked up his friend, punk musician Jonathan Hayner, and set out for Franklin, North Carolina. He wasn't alone. From all across the country, New Agers and retro hippies and spiritual seekers descended upon the Nantahala National Forest to join the event billed as a week of peace, love, harmony, and freedom. They arrived by the busload, by car and by van and by thumb, and an assemblage of saffron-robed Hare Krishnas rode in on the back of an elephant. Whatever their reasons for coming, whatever their beliefs, they entered along the same gravel drive, each of them passing beneath a sign that read, "Welcome Home." They pitched tents and teepees on the mossy forest floor beneath old-growth sycamore and basswood and washed in the waterfall nearby. They wove for each other beaded bracelets and braided their hair with purple asters, and despite run-ins with state troopers and wildlife officers, dedicated the week to their mission of achieving universal consciousness. Swept in the infectious communion, Maynard and Jonathan surrendered to the experience and all it might offer. In the afternoons, they joined the others in the meadow and listened to the words of Medicine's story, the graying Indian who'd been a gathering fixture since the first was held in 1972. The eagle feather he held was passed next to a shaman or a neo-pagan, a Buddhist or an Orthodox Jewess. Their stories of journeys and myths and mystical awakenings seemed to Maynard stories of people no different from himself. In the gathering dusk, he helped bring branches from the woods to feed the campfire, and sat in the circle of drumming and singing and more storytelling. Crimson sparks drifted into the darkening sky, and the first quarter moon gleamed white above the oaks and tulip poplars. And in the early morning of July 4th, the stories came to an end. The 7,000 walked quietly from their camps to the main meadow. In tie-dye and saris, faded jeans and black leather, they formed circles within circles and joined hands. Their silent meditation continued until noon, their breathing one breath. The sun rose high in the sky, and a collective om rose above the grasses and field flowers, echoed through the valley, and culminated in joyous shouts as children paraded from the kiddie village to the center of the circle, where they leapt and danced in the sunshine.
When thousands of people gather in a circle, in a 3-hour silent prayer, that shit's powerful. Think about all we could do if we were just quiet and agreed on something. Imagine marching on Washington with 30,000 people not saying a word, and then one person coming forward and saying, "This is what we want done." When we open our mouths, we screw it all up and assert our agendas. But if you're quiet, you feel the energy you visualize. You don't feel that until you just shut up. All these people holding hands were dead silent for hours, and even in that wonderful moment, I became aware that I'm stoned and wearing only a loincloth and sandals.
Maynard came home to find Grand Rapids going about its usual business. Housewives drove in from the suburbs to look at the new summer dresses at Herpelsheimer's. Kids practiced skateboard heel flips in the amphitheater, and office workers paraded to their cubicles in the morning. The Rainbow Gathering hadn't transformed the world after all. But Maynard returned buoyed by 4 days of heightened awareness amid bird song and sunshine, meals from the Hare Krishna kitchen, the hundreds of hopeful gathered for the express purpose of celebrating their collective tale. He'd never find words to explain it to Lori or his bandmates, he knew, but it somehow didn't matter. The experience had been his, one he would remember and draw upon later. And that, too, he realized, was a part of the tale. Neither did it matter much in his pitched state that while he'd been away, Bill had begun major renovations on the house, requiring his tenants to live elsewhere. Maynard's roommates, accustomed by then to his impetuosity, had assumed his North Carolina jaunt was no jaunt at all, but a permanent departure. He returned to find them gone, along with most of his possessions, sold or discarded or taken as their own. In one corner of his bedroom were his belongings. A few items of clothing, sketch pads and a clutch of Schaefer pens, a black footlocker, and Harpo's cage. Maynard unhooked the latch, and Harpo, a bit thinner perhaps after 4 days of neglect, fluttered out, perched on Maynard's shoulder, and took the seed he offered from his hand. Maynard and Ramiro set up their stereo in the living room of the apartment they rented in the fall. They filled the bookshelves with albums, Ramiro's Led Zeppelin and Foghat, and Maynard's Cocteau Twins, Depeche Mode, and Ministry. In the corners of the living room hung cages for Harpo and his offspring, and the collection of finches that completed Maynard's aviary. They flitted from potted ficus trees and back to their nests, where hungry chicks demanded to be fed. The birds trusted only Maynard and settled in his palm for their dinner of millet and grass seed. On most evenings, Lori joined them in spirited discussions of punk trends and anarchist ideals, the theories of Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung that Maynard and Ramiro studied in their history class. They'd found most fascinating the concept of synchronicity, a theory they thought just might have something to do with the odd coincidences and misfortune that seemed to be associated with Led Zeppelin's Kashmir. "We'd notice whenever it was played," Ramiro would remember. "It was always when something important was happening. I think it was just making us aware of things we might not otherwise have noticed. But we also liked the idea that it was some kind of mystical connection." And they talked, too, about the merits of sobriety. "Nothing to excess was a popular subject with all of us," Lori would recall. "We saw others around us doing too much anger, alcohol, or drugs, and we resolved to be careful not to do the same." The group looked forward most to movie night. After they'd finished their homework, Maynard and Ramiro would bring home Blue Velvet or Repo Man from the market nearby, often inviting Bill the landlord to add a generational dimension to their cinematic conversations. They envied his ability to set his own hours, to sit back at the end of the day and enjoy the fruits of his labor, and another viewing of Female Trouble. Maynard ran the Hoover over the floor, and Harpo, terrified of the noisy vacuum, perched on the relative safety of his shoulder. While he swept, he imagined lyrics and melody, and the wild idea that even humor could be incorporated into his act. The lack of rehearsal space in the new apartment, and lack of motivation among his bandmates, had meant the end of CAD and his duties as manager, accountant, advertising rep, and cheerleader. Unrestricted by the group's wishes and abilities, he allowed his imagination free rein. He incorporated in his music Eastern mantras, the African rhythms of Dead Can Dance, and spare industrial elements borrowed from swans. He emptied his footlocker and pulled it to the middle of the living room, creating from it a makeshift acoustic box. He held above it a length of heavy fencing chain, dropped it at regular intervals, and recorded the sound with his Tascam. Afterward, using sound delays and looping techniques, he cut into the recording his minimalist chant, "Anahata, not hit. Anahata, not struck." He and Ramiro had learned the word in Professor McCaffrey's history class, the mysterious Sanskrit word meaning unstruck. The word associated in the yogic tradition with the heart chakra, anahata, the only sound not made by one thing striking another. Anahata, the creative hum of the universe, the silence containing the antecedent of all things. Anahata, an echoing stillness rising over a meadow in North Carolina. Ramiro provided a steadying counterbalance to Maynard's growing attraction to the mystical. He included Maynard in family holiday gatherings and invited him on Sundays to share his mother's tortillas around a dinner table lively with conversation and laughter. And one afternoon, they returned from their errands to find the back door torn from its hinges, their television, their boombox and cameras, the four-track recorder and the stereo, gone, and with it, Led Zeppelin's physical graffiti album, the album that included Kashmir. "We were left without media," Ramiro would recall. "In hindsight, that was probably the best thing that could have happened to us. We started reading." With no television or stereo to occupy their free time, they took down their few books, cookbooks, a volume of Da Vinci color plates, the portable Jung, and the volumes they'd read in their history course, Joseph Campbell's Myths to Live By and Hero with a Thousand Faces, the only texts they hadn't resold to the student bookstore at semester's end. Ramiro had begun to struggle with the tenets of his Catholic upbringing, and Maynard's memories of the Ohio churches had led him to abandon organized religion altogether. But mysteries remained, and they visited tarot readers and studied cults ancient and new age, doubting there was such a thing as a spiritual path in the first place, and they found in Campbell a gentle guide. They spent long hours discussing and arguing Campbell's views on various belief systems, but found common ground in his more practical theories. The ultimate goal, Campbell insisted, was not to discover the meaning of life, but the experience of life, to listen to one's heart and to fearlessly follow one's passion.
"I came at Joseph Campbell from a fuck Christianity perspective. I was really into what he had to say because I loved the idea of undermining the fundamentalists. It was an interesting jump-off point after being in the middle of all that shit as a kid and watching people make decisions based on what seemed illogical. But Campbell turned out to be somebody who could actually give me the facts about mythology and archetypes and break apart the dogmatic views of religion in a way I could understand and appreciate. Professor McCaffrey really pushed us to see beyond the obvious and see things that connect cultures and different peoples rather than set us apart."
Only after proving competence in the basics were Kendall students allowed to experiment and bring personal expression to their work. Maynard generally ignored his instructor's preoccupation with classical elements. Rather than concentrate on vanishing points and shadowing and negative space, he preferred to embellish assignments with creative twists and to work beyond the exacting boundaries to discover approaches and interpretations all his own. Ramiro would later recall spending an entire week on the self-portrait assigned by instructor Sandra Stark, a project she'd explained must contain specific elements, a horizontal orientation, and the presence of a mirror within the frame, the entire piece done in graphite. The night before the assignment was due, Maynard assembled his drawing tablet and charcoal. He managed to incorporate most of the required elements, but departed from the assignment just enough to produce a portrait that unmistakably reflected his unique style. During the class critique, Stark pointed out the areas he hadn't drawn according to her guidelines, but even she admitted to the quality of his piece. "There was always that rebel side to Maynard," Ramiro would recall. "It was part procrastination because he was busy with music, but also part, I'm not going to do it exactly your way." Drawing instructor Deb Rockman understood Maynard's dilemma. "The portrait studies Maynard did for my class were excellent, But he was very, very conflicted about what he wanted to pursue, she would recall. I could see his talent, and could see that he was struggling to decide whether to focus on art or music. I certainly didn't try to sway him one way or the other. I just listened. He transferred that spring to Grand Valley State University, a few miles west of Grand Rapids. GVSU offered a course in printmaking, a less traditional program that would allow him the freedom to push conventional boundaries. I liked the process of taking blank pieces of copper and getting an image on paper, he would recall, including all the things I could do wrong. His enthusiasm was short-lived. Art, he thought as he drove home late one night from Top of the Rock, must unite the practical and the purely artistic, a combination his new school stressed no more than his old.
If I was going to do art, I was going to do some kind of functional art. If I'd stayed in the military, I would have probably been the guy going, no, 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 this backpack is all wrong. Let me design this more ergonomically so that when you reach your arm back, your hand lands on whatever you need without you having to think about it. I would have designed vehicles or gear to be utilitarian.
He thought of how his landlord managed to balance work and leisure, and his awareness of manual labor as an investment in after-hours enjoyment. Perhaps an evening with him was just what he needed to help put his priorities in order. He replaced the cassette in his tape deck as he neared Bill's house. Crickets chirped from the grasses along the roadside, their song a chant-like chorus filling the silence between Kraftwerk's rhythms. Staying in school wouldn't be the end of the world, Maynard told himself. He could, if he must, conform to the status quo, stay in the safe cocoon of Grand Rapids, and live out his career designing ergonomic office chairs and easy-to-open filing cabinets. Or he could take time out to regroup, step from the downward spiral of academic disappointment and financial insecurity. His time in the Army certainly hadn't prepared him for the economic juggling act required to live on his own. The military had provided his wardrobe, a bed to sleep in at night, and a wake-up call every morning. If he'd spent his stipend on the latest releases of Violent Femmes and REM, his meal card had still guaranteed him dinner until payday. Since returning to civilian life, and with only a rudimentary understanding of budgets and interest and late fees, he'd used his credit cards to finance CAD's non-paying gigs and to purchase recording equipment and the Chevy Sprint, running up balances he was in no position to pay. He relied on the car to travel to and from the Grand Valley campus, but the bank didn't take that into consideration. One afternoon, he returned to the apartment to find the spirit gone. Maynard had been uprooted often enough. He knew the essentials he must pack and the things he could leave behind. And Boston wasn't so far away. He could be there in no time, and the fold-out foam chair in Kurt's living room would be comfortable enough until he found an apartment of his own.
In theory, the energy of the universe wants to go in some direction. You have a goal, and the push and pull of opposites is what gets you there. Grand Rapids is a Garden of Eden, where rents are cheap, and family is nearby, and most people aren't motivated to leave because it's so easy to stick around. Here in the garden, everything's cozy. One school of thought says we've reached our goal when we have everything we need, and there are no distractions pulling us toward anything more. Keep all the conflict and darkness away, and life is perfect. Then you have to go to the other school of thought, which is, no, get out of the garden. Go into absolute chaos and struggle, and force yourself to accomplish something. In essence, Lucifer, or the serpent, is actually a necessary disruption, a motivation to get us moving toward our goal.
I didn't really think he would actually leave, Ramiro would recall. And then, suddenly one day, he was gone.